I speak with Alfred Guy, an educator at Yale University. He's the Director of Undergraduate Writing and Tutoring at the Porvoo Center and Assistant Dean of Academic Affairs at Yale College. We discuss AI's impact on teaching, learning, and evaluation. I appreciated the open and curious way he's approaching the topic of generative AI as an educator, putting the needs of the student at the forefront. I really enjoyed this conversation. What I found the most interesting was that it prompted fundamental questions like, what is the purpose of education? How best do students learn? And what is the role of a teacher? Do you have school-age kids? Are you a product of a college or university education? If so, this podcast will be of interest to you. Please enjoy my conversation with Alfred Guy. Welcome to the Super Prompt Podcast. Join me, your host, Tony Wan, as I go under the hood with AI experts, engineers, and entrepreneurs to explore burning questions, pitfalls, and best practices. Whether you're inside the industry or not, I hope to reveal something you haven't yet discovered. We laugh, we cry, we iterate. For early adopters of generative AI. I am pleased today to have with me Alfred Guy. And Alfred is a educator at Yale. And Alfred, first I'm gonna ask you how I should refer to you. Should I call you Professor Guy?
Most people just call me Alfie.
Alfie, okay, great. How I found Alfie is I really wanted to understand how universities were responding to generative AI. And I found that Yale University had published a guidance. And it was one of the few universities that actually had published the guidance, and not any university. It's a very prestigious university who has published a guideline. And I just worked my way to finding Alfie, who kindly responded to me. And I wanted to have this conversation to explore the topic a bit more about AI's impact on universities, particularly around teaching and testing and evaluating students. So Alfie, tell us a little bit about yourself. You know, what's your backstory? How'd you end up in your current role? And tell us a little bit about the Porvoo Center at Yale University.
So at the Porvoo Center, where I work now, I was hired originally to Yale because they wanted to start a writing requirement. In 2004, it was still possible to craft your Yale education in a way to avoid writing classes if you wanted to. Most students didn't. And the goal was to help build a requirement that would stay flexible, but make sure everyone had some practice. And in addition to working on the curriculum with faculty members, the courses are all taught by people who do not report to me. We also were enhancing tutoring services for students so that students could come for help with writing in any field at any time. I'm mentioning this because when the Porvoo Center was created about 7 years ago, I ended up, we're called the Porvoo Center for Teaching and Learning, and I oversee most of the learning services that we offer for undergraduates. We also have a graduate writing lab, which is run by someone else who's awesome. And so the you know, just to jump straight to generative AI for a minute, we might go backwards again in a second. In November, when ChatGPT 3.5 was released, some of my writing program friends started writing about it on Facebook immediately. And I brought up at a staff meeting here the question of whether we should be developing a response to it.
And this is November 2022 you're talking about. Okay.
And I brought up in December at a staff meeting, you know, maybe we should be thinking about this. And people had not heard enough about it yet to even to have fear or excitement. And I ended up saying, well, I'm going to talk to the writing teachers about it at the very least at the beginning of the semester. So let's think about putting something together. So a lot of people worked on that webpage that you're thinking about, and it was followed pretty quickly by a faculty panel where we got faculty members to talk out loud about how they were feeling about this prospect. I'm proud of the tone of that guidance, which was curious, exploratory, not alarmist. And it turned out, when we invited people to speak on this panel, we didn't actually know what they were going to say. We didn't vet them at all. And they ended up similarly saying, you know, there's reasons to think hard about how this will affect our lives, but let's not start by trying to ban it or outlaw it or be suspicious of our students. So in an ongoing way, the Center for Teaching and Learning has now ended up working with a lot of people thinking about, should I be putting more AI in my class? Should I be trying to AI-proof my class? And I've just tried to keep up. You know, I just tried to read as much as I can.
Yeah, the guidance that we're both talking about can be found at parvucenter.yale.edu/AI guidance. But I think if you Google Yale AI guidance, it might come up. I think that's all you need to do to find it. And, you know, I thought it was pretty much more telling your teaching staff what to think about. You know, it wasn't really telling them what to do, but like, here are some things you might consider. And I think at this stage of the game, that was really great. I think that was a great tone and positioning versus thou shalt do this or thou shalt not do this. I think we're all trying to figure it out.
I think that tone that you're talking about, some of it does reflect a genuine thoughtfulness on behalf of the people who work here. I will say that I'm proud of the way we responded to it. But some of it also fits with the Yale tradition of the relationship between anyone central, anyone whose job it is to put things in public or raise general questions, and the faculty. And that relationship, which I'm very happy about, is faculty get to say what they're going to do. So the guidance could have been more doubting or worrying, but there's no way it could have told people exactly what to do. So what we contributed was offering a spirit of patience and calm and cheerfulness and thoughtfulness. But even if we'd been worried and concerned, our things to think about would have just been more worrying and less hopeful. We still couldn't tell people what to do. And I'll just mention that this has been a feature of my job at Yale the whole time, because I oversee a writing requirement that's taught in 40 departments, much of it by tenured faculty. And they don't have to do what I say at all, which is good because it actually fits my educational philosophy that the person in the room should teach what they believe in. But it also is a practical administrative matter that, you know, Yale faculty are smart and know that they're smart and want to do what they believe in. So you can coach them and encourage them, but you really just can't dictate to them.
What might be a triggering event where there need to be a more explicit university-wide policy? Could there be such an event, or is the teaching philosophy such that there would never be a situation like that, that you would always give the control or the ability to kind of allow professors to shape their own, their own program?
So I can think of three things that are resonant with your question, relevant to your question. I'm still not sure any of them would result in an absolute dictated solution. But one, a concern we're trying to figure out right now, I'm actually working on language that will go on the website this week, about how much professors can require students to engage particular AI tools, since we know that all software companies are trying to leverage your data, and that large language models in particular may be leveraging your input, using your input to make their product better, but also trying to track your activity in other places, trying to market to you and your friends. And I'm not criticizing that activity on its own, but there's something potentially problematic about requiring students who we have some authority over to participate in particular ventures that have a commercial aspect. And so there may come guidance. It probably wouldn't be the same guidance forever, but there may come guidance that says either you can't require students to do this. If you want students to use a large language model, there have to be alternate ways to complete the assignment. There may. I'm not saying that there will, but protecting students from something is one condition in which there might come something stronger than just, here's some things to think about, make your own decision. That's one. A thing that we'll probably talk more about in this very conversation, online exams where students are not with you and can use a computer, They've been phasing out at Yale over time anyway, at least in Yale College. They have a different role in each of the professional schools, but the idea that you would have students answer specific questions while you're not there using a computer has reduced in importance over the time. And I could see a time when AI response to factual questions or even synthetic factual questions is so powerful that there's at least a very, very strong suggestion that you not put too much of your course weight on an exam that students take at the end on their own. So, you know, that was sort of veering towards, I still don't think it would be dictated. The one thing about when guidelines do come down from, let's just call it Yale Central for a minute, the provost's office, the president's office, they're very often the first thing they say is each school, which has a dean, can make its own policies. And the deans in each of the schools will want to work with their own faculty to come up with a policy. But it is the case that there are things at Yale that people have to do because the dean and the faculty have come to an agreement about what to do. So for instance, if you're teaching Yale College, you have to include in your course proposal some language about how you're going to teach students about academic integrity. There's a huge range of ways that people do that, and no one tries to dictate that. But it's sort of a commonly agreed practice that new courses have to attend to it to some degree. You know, there are things that are dictated or centralized or regularized, but they tend to be worked out between the dean and the faculty, and then still to have a fair amount of room in them. And I said three things, but I only said those are two.
Yeah, I was waiting for the third.
Yeah. I don't know if I really had three different ones in mind in my head. Those are two.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting because so on those two things, so I started out by asking what might be a triggering event or something that might encourage the university to put out a more broader policy that covers the entire university. And the first one you mentioned about protecting students, that's a very interesting one because there's things that these technology companies say they are or aren't doing, but there's lots of wiggle room around that statement, you know? So for instance, I believe OpenAI came out with this statement. I haven't double-checked this, but something to the effect of, we're not going to use your data inputted to train our models. Something like that. I would love to get an AI, OpenAI legal type person on the podcast, actually, if they would be brave enough to come on. You know, I'm like, I'm sharing a lot of what is going on in my mind with ChatGPT. And I was actually thinking for myself, maybe it'd be useful to set up an anonymous ID that isn't my real name so that my information isn't, if it is accidentally exposed, you know, there's purposeful use and then there's accidental exposure. And I think we have to be concerned about both. These things happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting because I didn't even think of it as identified. Like that, of course, is terrifying to me. The possibility that it would be made public what I had asked for and how I had responded to it with my name attached to it. Thank you for giving me a new thing to worry about.
I had only
been thinking about implicitly or without explicit agreement contributing to other people's business models. I will say the thing you're saying about whether OpenAI has said they won't do that, I don't know that for sure, but I know that Anthropic has said that. Like I've read it directly from them that they say we're not using your input to train our models. It does seem to me that the LLMs that are attached to live internet activity, I don't see how they're going to get any better if they don't do some of that. In the same way that Google is as good as it is because it paid attention to what people were searching for. I mean, so I'm going to say it's not just I don't know where they're putting that line, but I don't even know that I would understand how that line could work.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, I mean, what they could do, I have no idea what they're really doing is, this process of training is massively compute intense. And that's why I think the GPT model, the knowledge cutoff is what, 2021, something like that. You would wonder, why isn't it 2023? Yeah, it's just to go out and suck in this incredible amount of data and to crunch on it. I don't think they can do that comprehensively many times. Mm-hmm. So maybe a few years, maybe it's this year or next year, they'll do that massive like vacuuming up of all data. And, you know, this podcast is going to be fair game. It's public domain, you know, so it's a little bit scary to think that all of this, my transcript, my voice is going to be using, will be used to train the next large language model. It will likely be used to train the next large language model. But my private queries is a different matter, you know.
Right.
My private queries, I expect to stay private. But, you know, let's say, you know, there hasn't been this crazy, like, newsworthy Google leak yet of, like, all of your Gmail content, for instance. Because, you know, these guys have incredible teams in place, security teams in place to prevent that. Because that would be a PR disaster. It would impact the value of the company. But let's say you start using the software of a little startup, you know, maybe they're flying fast, you know, as Mark Zuckerberg used to say, you know, break things and fix it later. Maybe there's a data leak from a little company. I'm heartened that the first thing that you mentioned was protecting the students. Like, that's fantastic. I actually didn't expect that. And the second thing you mentioned that might trigger a change in policy was, remind me again.
Yeah, sure. So we, you know, you and I already know that depending upon what your question is, a large language model would do a pretty decent job of answering it right now. Like in a lot of subjects, if you asked it. So if you were doing an exam and had a lot of weight in your final grade on students taking the exam, they were taking the exam at home, and the, you know, your questions were of things that are known in the world. We've been recommending that people not do that for a while anyway. And it's not just because of concerns about cheating or fairness. It's also because that's not the most long-term way of having people have a subtle and flexible understanding of the material. Like, we just, you know, research shows that application and more low-stakes engagement with the material is better than a one heavyweight exam. But so there's already been some guidance about that under the guise of learning. But you know, as large language models get better and better and can work on more and more material, I think the guidance about don't do that will get stronger.
How much experimentation have you done personally with ChatGPT?
So I've probably had 25 sessions with it. You know, so on 25 different days, I've spent some time working with it. That's one answer. And each of those times, I've probably averaged 8 to 10 experiments. Then that some of them with multiple promptings, still counting as one of the 8 to 10, and some of them just one shots. So I guess I'm saying that I've probably, you know, tried to get it to write 100 to 200 different kinds of things in my usage of it, and not much more than that. I've probably read 300 articles that other people wrote about it, and it's, I'd say, you know, that since November 2022, the cycle for me has been trying it out for a while, then taking a few weeks to talk about what I had figured out and reading more about what people were doing, and then getting to a point in my reading where the people who were writing about things that I didn't know it could do or I didn't understand, so I had to go back and try it some more. One time this past spring, I brought a ChatGPT essay into my class on a topic that another student had written an essay about, and we had a very good discussion about why, I'll just say, Sophia's essay was better than the ChatGPT essay. And one of my students said, basically at the end of the conversation, students all agreed, I want to be more like a human writer and less like a bot writer. But one of my students said, this looks like it's written by 3.5. Is that what you're using, 3.5? And I said, yes. And she said, 4.0 is a lot better than this. I think it would have done a better job on this prompt. So that was when I signed up for a professional account so I could try, you know, another layer of work. So that, you really just were asking me how much have I done. So that I'm trying to give you a little, like a fat answer to that question.
Yeah, it's to me, it's important that you've actually played with it. There's plenty of people trying to form an opinion on this technology without actually playing with the technology. I'm like, that's not a good starting point. And so that was the reason I asked, having a hand in creating the AI guidance and also being on staff or being part of the university. Is there any general comment you can make about the kinds of people and how they respond? Like, can you say generally these group these departments are more open, these departments are more closed, these departments are moving more aggressively, these departments are a little bit more reserved. Anything, any general observations about how different departments are responding and how different kinds of people are responding?
Sure. I mean, I'll generalize a little. I want to say that this is, I haven't written these down. So and I'm going to say, for instance, something about the computer science colleagues I've talked to, and I've talked to six or eight of them more than once. I think I can generalize how their attitude is a little calmer than pretty much everybody else for some specific reasons. At the same time, if anyone's listening to this and they're in the computer science department at Yale and they're not feeling calm, I apologize that I left you out. This is, I didn't do a survey. In fact, I'm working on a project this year, starting in the fall, where we are going to much more systematically interview a lot, faculty in a lot of disciplines and think about these questions. But I have talked to lots of people. So I'll say the computer scientists have said, and we've been dealing with programs that can write code for 15 to 20 years, and we've worked out how to give students small pieces of work to do that are harder or more unusual, how to set conditions so that they'll at least begin to try on their own before they turn it over to a machine. And we feel pretty confident that we'll be able to do the same kind of tweaking with how well ChatGPT, for instance, writes code. And so in other words, I don't think their calmness or their slightly more upbeat attitude is just because they think, oh, making machines do things is cool. That might be an element of it. But it's actually because they've worked on the educational problem already before, because there's something repetitious about code.
I was going to add that because I'm a graduate of a computer engineering program, I think the testing and evaluation thing is a pretty good way to check if someone's really learning. And if they can't use AI to write software, it's still, they could use it all they want during the semester, but if in the exam they can't use it, you're going to know pretty quickly if they really understand the fundamental concepts.
Yeah.
I think testing evaluation maybe in the humanities is way more challenging.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I hope we'll talk a lot about that because I have a lot of thoughts about that. But I will say that the humanities faculty who have, let's say, been the most upset, concerned, provoked by this discussion, have not been focused on my students will turn in work that they didn't do. I think in part because here at Yale, I mean, I think this is a practical reason why their concern is in a different spot. Our classes are small. Our humanities classes are small. I mean, I wouldn't say the humanities are not in trouble here, but the student-teacher ratio is a lot better in the humanities. So there's plenty of chances to talk to your students, ask them questions. Like you were saying, evaluation and grading in computer engineering works a certain way. And I'm saying that the daily experience of class works a certain way in the humanities here, that you get a sense of who's doing the work. And you have a chance to poke each student at whatever level they're at. And so I don't think their first feeling is the biggest problem here is that students won't write their own papers, but rather that certainly we found you or you found us through general email we have that just says, ask Porvoo a question. And we get questions in there that say, I used to give a take-home exam. What should I do now? I wouldn't say those have been set at red alert level, but they're obviously, I have a practical concern that's based upon what I'm hearing about how this technology works. And probably, again, putting computer science aside, those questions are reasonably spread across the STEM fields and the social science fields and the humanities fields. Like just different people depend on exams in different ways. And I learned at one of these workshops that we have here how good ChatGPT was at writing the explanation of chemistry problems. I didn't know that. I learned that from a chemist here who said, no, if you give it a problem set, it explains the steps really well.
Yeah. So I guess my thought of what might be just a very simple answer, but I don't know why I haven't heard it proposed as a simple answer, is that really addressing this from a test evaluation perspective where students and teachers leverage AI in the learning process, don't weight homework very much, weight in-person proctored exams way more. Like I was suggesting, maybe 80% of the grade comes from a proctored in-person, in-class exam. In the humanities, it might be largely focused on writing about a particular topic. In computer engineering, it would be, you know, problem sets or that are done in a proctored way without access to the internet. Why wouldn't that be just a very simple way to allay most people's concerns about the use of this technology? Like, why isn't that, wouldn't that work across most classes? And then now you can use AI in whatever creative way to help the learning process. And at the end, if the student is over-relying on it, it self-corrects because they'll fail the exam because they haven't learned the material.
So the reliance on something at the end that has a lot of weight produces a lot of other problems. And if your course is already designed that way, then yes, I would agree with you. Replacing the do it online with the do it in person is fine. If there's some way that you were already only giving students 2.5 hours to answer a certain set of questions, then yes, you can bring them back into class and give them 2.5 hours to answer that set of questions. But there are a lot of fields in which that's not what the final assessment was based upon. It was based upon something else, a different kind of work. In my field, it's writing a paper where you're making an original argument, and it to do it well takes working on it, letting it go aside for a while, coming back to it, getting some feedback, working on it again. And these are things that are not that easy to approximate in a one-swipe setting.
Can I just pause you there? Because this is a very interesting topic. But even if it's like not one time, maybe it's like four times, you know, four proctored exams during the course of a semester.
Yeah. So that's when I said there are variations on this that I think would work. That exactly what I was thinking is that if you had four exams, then yes, I would agree with you. And actually, you know, our natural science classes work that way. They have what are sometimes called three midterms, which obviously doesn't make any sense in division, but it's three exams of a similar weight to a midterm, but you have them at the 1/3, 2/3, and end of the year version. And then there might sometimes be a fourth test that's a little bit more comprehensive of everything. And yes, I would actually agree with you that this is a very good way to preserve a certain kind of testing and evaluation. I'm going to go to a space I don't know that well, but there are probably logistical complications, but those that can be worked out. Like it might be that, you know, doing the exams online makes them easier to grade in some way. I don't just mean automated grading. I mean, like you can read their handwriting. But basically, I think you're right that in classes that used to depend on a big final exam, it's actually basically all the research in the world would say four medium exams is better than one big exam anyway for learning, not just for fairness and cheating. So I think you're right about that. I think generally speaking, I said we were already trying to move people away from a big exam at the end for learning purposes anyway. And then there's this movement in education studies. It's sometimes called authentic assessment. Have you heard that? I think of it as a slight jargon term. So it basically means you should be grading students on doing things that are like the things professional people do in this same field as much as possible, and even within the conditions that a professional might undertake. So, for instance, having them have access to some tools and apply their knowledge to an unknown situation. But, you know, I think it's wonderful. But there's a student-teacher ratio problem here. Like, to do those kinds of more nuanced assessments, you have to have fewer students or more teachers, because each one has to be judged a little more carefully than just, did you get their answers right on the test? And the only other thing I'll say about the reason your revision of this plan, which is to do it four times instead of once, is especially good, is we don't want to set up a system where students find out that the AI was harming them at the end. We want them to learn that mistake or not harming
them.
You know what I mean? But like, if we were only running a prize competition, that would be fine. But since we're actually trying to help people learn, you know, we want to give them the feedback sooner when they can correct along the way.
If you're working for your master's or PhD, a lot of it's dependent on original research and coming up with a thesis. And that's a really long project. Is AI of less concern to like people at the research / graduate level? And is that more of a concern at the undergraduate level? Could you generally make that statement?
So remembering that I work primarily, I mean, I work across the whole university, but I spend most of my energy thinking about Yale College, thinking about undergraduates. I am going to answer your question. You know, some of the professional schools are concerned about this because there's a, especially in the first year, let's say, of a master's program, there's a lot of material that we want students to learn so they're in a position later to do original research. We want them to sort of get the lay of the field and the big arguments and sort of what have been the two or three, you know, big controversies that really need work. You have to do a fair amount of background to figure these things out. And one of the approaches is to have, you know, sort of, they're not really basic survey courses, but let's say courses that are more, tend more towards surveying the field early. And testing has been one of the ways of giving feedback to students on how well they're mastering the material. And although, you know, having been to a PhD program, I would say anybody who goes into a PhD program just for a credential is not making a good trade-off because it's, you know, it's not miserable, but it's not a good use of your time and energy if all you're looking for is to step some ladder. Nonetheless, certainly there are people whose lives would be improved after the fact if they get a master's degree from a prestigious university. So I'm trying to, without casting aspersions on any particular person or discipline, I'm trying to say there are incentives for people to take shortcuts in their master's work, or there might seem to be temptations to let a large language model do some of the synthesizing and summary of all the positions in a field so you can turn your paper in, depending upon what else is going on in your life. And maybe you're a master's student, but you're borrowing money, so you're working to try and defray that. Maybe you have a young family. There are reasons why it would seem to be tempting to let ChatGPT do the preliminary work during your master's program, even if you still had a vision of being able to do more original work later in your program.
Okay. When you say tempted to use, you mean like tempted to cheat or tempted to use it to help you learn? These are two different things.
Yeah.
You know, so, because if you use it to cheat on the underlying groundwork, you're not going to be able to come up with the original ideas.
Sure. But I'm not sure 23-year-olds understand that, who are not yet experts in the field. And again, I don't mean to be ageist about it, but I feel like, and when I say cheat, I don't mean that when the person does it, they think that they're cheating.
Okay.
But I mean that they have a task in front of them. The task seems to be to produce text that summarizes and synthesizes and lays out the positions of.
Well, let's use chemistry as an example. Let's say it's a pre-med student. Okay. There's chemistry classes they have to take, you know, organic chemistry, blah, blah, blah. And I remember this, like in school, like that would drive people insane. Organic chemistry is hard, and these pre-med students are all like trying to crunch through it, knowing that that's not what they want to do. They want to be doctors, you know? So let's say you use ChatGPT to answer all your organic chemistry problem sets, you know, including the take-home exam, you know, and you're like, hooray, I'm done with that thing I don't really want to do. Now, if it was truly foundational, it would impact them later. If it wasn't foundational, it wouldn't impact them later. And then you have to question, why are we requiring these students to take inorganic chemistry or organic chemistry if it really wasn't helping them to become a doctor? Okay. And I bring this up specifically because I have a computer engineering degree, and I know for a fact that there are courses that were not important for me to do what I needed to do as a computer engineer. And if I had access to ChatGPT, I would be highly tempted to use it to just not put any time because I was getting zero sleep as it was, you know? So, like, I guess what I'm pointing out is, isn't this a self-correcting problem where if it's truly necessary, they're going to hurt themselves and they'll correct their behavior? If it really isn't necessary, well, then you have to ask, why are we making them do it?
Yeah.
You know, so why isn't the problem self-correcting? You know, this is
a really amazing question in a way. I mean, like, there's no simple answer. I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I don't have a secret hidden disagreement that I'm going to pop out as like a rabbit out of a hat. It's a layered question, though, because I think there's a lot. In order to come to some answer about whether it is or isn't okay, you have to make a lot of assumptions about different people's motives and their awareness. I know I'm making this really vague, but I'm going to do some scenarios in a second, just to say I certainly, one of the outcomes of my flowchart thinking about what you're asking me is exactly where you are, that it's somewhat self-correcting. But when you say, for example, when you use the example of yourself, that there are classes that you know weren't helping you, I don't know if you knew that 20 years ago. You're probably not 20 years from your master's, 15 years ago, 10 years ago. Like, I think you know that differently now than you did then. I also think that designing a curriculum is not just a science. Like, it's not just a recipe. It's also an art. And it's possible that if you had ended up doing a different kind of, I don't know which courses you're talking about, but if you'd ended up doing a different kind of computer engineering, some of those courses would look different in relief. Or I wonder if some of those courses are useful to you doing a podcast about Silicon Valley, but even though they didn't help you write code. And I have some, you know, institutions are messy and they correct very, very slowly. And yet I have some faith in your professors, in your faculty, that they had some sensible, heartfelt reasons for building the curriculum the way that they did. They might have had some cynical reasons too, but that some of them. But I assume organic chemistry is actually useful for most doctors, although lots of things in American education, and I say American education, it might be true other places, are gatekeepers for something else. Like, they're proxies, they're test proxies so that we can sort and apportion resources. Like, they're not intrinsically, cognitively necessary. Nonetheless, I assume organic chemistry is useful for a lot of doctors. But I'm also guessing that the people who teach organic chemistry are thinking, well, some people who want to be doctors are going to end up working for Pfizer, and I'd like them to have some organic chemistry. And some people who end up being doctors might spend most of their lives not having to worry about organic chemistry, but then they get a patient who reacts a certain way to a certain drug in, you know, pre-AI, they're going to have to think about, well, why is it? Why would they be doing that? So I'm worried about self-correcting. I'd like to see ongoing feedback, and I'd love to see the professors listen to their students when they say this does or does not feel useful and really pay attention to it. I don't think things should just be blindly accepted, but I'm uncomfortable with the idea that, you know, just sort of building the testing a different way and then letting the chips fall is necessarily going to be for everyone's good. Now, I know you probably want to interrupt, but I'm going to say one more thing first, which is, at the same time, the most exciting thing about your question is the insight that having a large language model available and other forms of super high computed work that you can just access by going on a website raises questions that probably are 100 years in the waiting, like whether or not X is really necessary before you do Y, and the best way to teach it is to do Z. I'm so excited that we're raising these questions. And I'm sure the answer is going to be really different. Even if everyone tried to give the most good faith interpretation, we're going to see education is going to look different. I heartily agree with.
Yeah. As you were explaining your viewpoint, it occurred to me that these are really fundamental questions about education that we're talking about. Because if you look at education as, okay, well, this is a way to just purely make me effective at a chosen profession, that's one way to look at education. Another way to look at education, well, it's really shaping how I think. If it's shaping how I think, and its value is over the entire span of my life and how I think, well, maybe that course that I took that I thought wasn't directly impacting, you know, my ability to land a job XYZ after I graduate, maybe it has greater value than that. And maybe I should be paying more attention to it. And you're right, as a 18-year-old, I may not have that perspective. So, the reason I'm pushing on this testing concept is more this idea of, like, I think it's a good stopgap, you know? So let's put that in place so we're not all panicking and then figure out what is a more considered approach. That was just, to me, it's a blunt tool, you know? It's not a very sophisticated way to deal with it. But I'm like, well, while we're all trying to figure out how the world is changing, maybe we need just a reasonable stopgap solution so that people aren't questioning the value of the degree we're granting, you know? Mm-hmm. These are all, it's all fascinating. Actually, I wanted to go back to what you were saying earlier about one of the unique characteristics of Yale in that it seems that the class sizes are a bit smaller and that there's a higher teacher to student ratio. And, you know, the arguments I've heard made for, you know, this kind of ratio, and that ratio actually is very well debated on how it's actually debated if that actually improves education. I'm sure you know of those debates, but usually the context where I've heard it is more, you know, primary, secondary school, not so much university. But it occurred to me that AI could be flipping things around where originally we were thinking about a great student-teacher ratio as to help teaching, but maybe it's more to help the evaluating. If truly you're creating this very supportive environment and you're really concerned about if the student really is learning and you have the benefit of the student teaching, a good student teaching ratio, I could see how that could really help in the evaluating. Is the student really getting this? And not so much for the teaching, but more for the evaluating, the weight of that. It changes the equation. Like, you know what I'm getting at? Like, mm-hmm. What?
I do. Although I will say that in that formula, I agree with you. And it does, I think, also flow out of what I was saying about, you know, authentic assessments being more complicated and requiring more nuanced judgment. But you're equating teaching with delivery of information so that you can make a split between the teaching and the evaluating. You know, in other words, maybe it's not necessary for the delivery of the information or the staging of the initial learning. Maybe we don't need a better ratio for that, but we need a better one for evaluation. And I would just put the word feedback in there and say that feedback on how you're processing the material is part of teaching / learning. And so the reason to have humans have not too many other humans that they're having to pay attention to is so they can give feedback that's particular to how that student is doing. And so, you know, I have read, I've read mostly the summaries of and occasionally the background paper of a lot of these discussions of teacher-student ratio. And I'm sure this reflects a bias, but my experience has been the ones that support lower student-teacher ratios seem more realistic to me than the ones that debunk it. Like that the method of checking progress and improvement on the studies that show it doesn't make a difference seem more superficial to me. And I don't think that's entirely bias. I think, you know, that people can value, two people having to decide how to organize a class can value different things in the outcomes. But the things that I value make me pretty dubious of the ones that say it doesn't matter if there's 38-year-olds in the room or 15. Like every single person who votes on that is sending their kid to a school where there's 15 in the room and not 30. Like, you know, every one of the 50% of millionaires in Congress are sending their kids to a school with a good teacher-student ratio. And so I don't disagree with you that the impact of different big scale changes in classrooms are hard to measure. I absolutely grant that. Definitely. And I actually like the emphasis you're putting here on the shift from thinking about, you know, how well do the students pay attention when the teacher's talking to the whole group may not be the focus. The focus maybe should be on how well can the teachers deliver individualized feedback, which I'm not even saying they do enough of or that it's that education is designed enough in that direction. But I do think that's a much richer, hotter place to be thinking about. You know, why do we need smaller classes?
So in that feedback, so I have a two-part exploration on what you just said. One is the feedback. Well, AI is actually quite good at checking whether you really understand something, actually. You could probably expand the student-teacher ratio a bit and have AI do some of the heavy lifting when it comes to feedback. But one thing AI is not good at, and the key to actually getting AI to give you a good response, is you gotta give it the context. Like, and so basically you've heard this technical term context window, and that context window gets bigger and bigger with each rev of GPT, for instance. In every large language model, the goal is to give you a bigger, bigger context window, because the computer engineers know that the more context you give it, the better its response. So these companies are constantly trying to expand the context window. So if you apply that to students and each student's unique. And if the ratio is small and the teachers get to know the students personally, they have a full appreciation of that student's context, you know, where they're from, what their background is, strengths, weaknesses, what they want to do in the future, their concerns. If you have an involved teacher like that, it makes the feedback that much better and more valuable. And this idea of a small teacher-to-student ratio, you know, I think it you can make the argument that in a AI world, that's still important, presuming the teachers actually care about the students, yeah.
Right, absolutely, which is an assumption, like, it's obviously not always true, but we do operate from it. The teachers are working in good faith to the best of their ability all the time, we do. And I know that's not always true, but we do certainly have to trust in that. And I think it's true of most. My wife is a retired elementary school teacher, and certainly, you know, she still talks about students every single day, you know, students from multiple years ago and their particular needs, partially because we have a five-year-old and we're doing a lot of comparisons. But anyway, I wanted to just say, I really think in this case in particular, you're coming to two conclusions about this shows richness. I'm not your teacher. I'm not trying to just praise you. But I think you're right that this question is a really interesting question because you could see how AI could leverage some of what it does well to give students some help that would help them learn. And then theoretically, they wouldn't need to get that exact same help from a teacher so the teacher could have more students. And then on the other hand, because humans can understand context more richly so far, it would be really valuable for giving feedback on performance to have the teacher have fewer students to think about. I know I'm just recapping what you just said, but one of the things I want to add into this conversation, it's going to get a little squishy. It's not like I've been using science very much anyway, but this is going to get even squishier. The student performance in the first place, the student engagement with the material, the student listening and then saying things, a lot of it draws on 2 billion years of evolution to be part of the communicative act with other humans. And it's probably not 2 billion years. It's probably since there were social animals. But what I'm trying to say is people hear differently, often better, and they speak and think more richly when they're engaged with a real human relationship. And there's a lot of research on how even approximations of this make a difference, so that if you give people something to do and it feels to them as that they are alone, they don't do as well as if they are asked to imagine the person they're speaking to, look at a picture. And I'm not saying these things you can approximate to improve performance to say, therefore, we could continue to approximate and ultimately do just as well with non-human teachers. I'm actually saying these approximations point to the fact that something about us is built to think and learn and communicate and engage with other humans, and that keeping that alive and keeping that vibrant makes learning work better. So I know this is true. There is evidence for a lot of the pieces of it, but you know, we haven't had decent enough non-human tools to do controlled studies of people over a long term, blah, blah, blah. But
this gets very interesting because I know there's research about how children cannot learn language from a video. You know, they can't learn it. You can't just put them in front of an iPad and have them learn French. It just doesn't work. They need the actual live person. Now, if you repeat that experiment with AI, who knows? You know, like, because now let's say it's an AI teaching your child French, Spanish, Mandarin. Could a child learn? I think the results are going to be different. I think it's AI isn't 100% human, but it gets close enough where it's not like they're not going to learn something. They're going to learn something. Now, I can't wait for those studies, like, because someone's probably doing that study right now, and I think we're going to be shocked at the result. But that AI who's teaching that child French knows nothing about the child. You know, like, I think, like, to have an actual person care about you, understand your context so that they can relate to you, not in a fake way, but in a real way, that still has value. But man, this, we're still early. Like, let's say, you know, in the same way there's like digital natives now, like they've not grown up in a world without the internet. I mean, there's going to be a point in time where a child's not going to know a reality different than talking to AI, you know? So as from a baby, you know, there's going to be babies talking to AI, and they'll never have known a world where they haven't talked to AI. And if AI starts learning about you at that point in time, it's going to understand a lot of your context. Oh, remember you fell off your bicycle when you were age 4 because you talked to me about how to, like, what's the best way to, you know, care for a skinned knee, you know? Like, if you start playing that world out, it's very hard to imagine things AI can't do, you know? Like, is it going to be the same as me talking to Alfie, you know? Not now, but give it some time. And particularly if it's just text, it's going to start text, you know, then it's going to go into voice. Like, it's voice is hard. It's hard to imitate my inflection and where I'm putting the stress. And there's all these harmonics going on in my voice, and it's connected to my body, you know. So that's one order of magnitude problem, but it can be solved. Now, imagine a video likeness of me. You know, you can imagine a world where a lot of the quote-unquote human interaction is being replaced. So, you know, what we're talking about now is a very, it's a problem of the now. And I think those are useful problems to solve in the now. But the future, I don't think anything that we're talking about now applies to the future.
Mm-hmm. I grant your vision. Okay, I know that you're right, that in every way, the technology is going to get better and better at doing all those things. I totally grant that. There's no but coming. I want to just jump back a little bit to one part of our conversation where we were talking about one formulation of it was, could an AI-assisted classroom be as effective with a slightly more students in the room because the AI does some work that, you know, can't get done? And that seems possible to me. Certainly, if we limit the kind of, I'm not putting artificial limits, I just mean if we define carefully which things it's going to do and not do, I'm sure you're right. That seems absolutely right to me. My sense of how education works in America is that it would be better to add more support in education than to try and do just as well. In other words, if we could afford to AI assist more classrooms, I'd like to see it with just as many teachers to start out with, because I just honestly don't think we're doing well enough now. And so
meaning instead of like having less teachers, servicing more students is it basically
servicing the same number of students better. You know, I think the education in America ends up leaning harder on its gatekeeping and ranking function than on its goal to have every human thrive. And so if large language models and other forms of generative AI can be harnessed to help 10-year-olds learn better, I'd rather see that as an add-on at first, because I think the way education works now in America, that there's too much acceptance of, I don't want to say it's designed for, but there's too much acceptance of it benefiting some students a lot and other students only a little and some students barely at all. And I'd if AI is really that great, let's take the students in.
But I don't understand the point you just made. Like you said, it benefits some students more than others.
The way elementary school math works, one of its main functions is to figure out who gets to go to the seventh grade advanced math and who gets to stay in basic math and who is going to get remedial math. And then, you know, by 10th grade, it's who we're going to encourage to go to vocational school and who are we going to let drop out. Not everyone has to turn out the same way at the end of an education process. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying, though, that it's a little bit resource-based, that gifted and talented programs have better, for instance, student-teacher ratios and money for field trips and people working on their curricula and better college counseling.
You know, and that's an interesting point, actually, because, like, it's quite possible. Like, you know, there are certain disciplines we're trying to get more people into. And it's quite possible that just with a little bit of help, you can get more people into those disciplines that may have needed just a little bit more attention, say, to math. Like, let's say, I'm not saying it's societal good is served by having more engineers, but let's just say we wanted more engineers. And, you know, math is a big deal. And maybe math, some people are better at it. Some people are less good at it. And so maybe with a little bit more help, we could get some people just over the bar, the math bar, such that they could become a future engineer, you know, and with the current budgets of where, you know, secondary primary schools are, we just don't have the budget to get everyone over that bar. And maybe with AI, now there's more people that can get over that bar. That could be a very positive.
I agree. I'm glad you agree. And then what I'm trying to say with it politically, in other words, there's an intellectual conversation we're having about could this work and could that work. But what I'm saying more politically is, I think most technologies that can reproduce human work have had as their ultimate goal extracting more profit from labor so that it can go into the hand of the capitalists. Like, I just think that's just true. And that's a prospect here as well. If you really could have fewer teachers and make education cost less, or have some of the money go to the people who created OpenAI instead of to individual public school teachers, either way, you know, if it's the same amount of money, but other people are getting it, or if it's less money because you have fewer teachers, it seems to me there's going to be a big drive to go in that direction. And they're going to persuade Americans who don't own software companies that it's a good idea by saying we're going to lower your taxes. But a driving force, let's not say the goal, but a driving force of that is going to be to keep reallocating what's now public money spent on education to fewer and more private hands. And I would rather see us spend at least the same amount of money and help more students to get a little bit higher up. And I'm not even thinking, you know, I think your example is a good example. I can give you another example, which is just nursing. Like, you know, I'm reading I have an older daughter who's going to be a nurse in December, and I'm reading every day about how there's nursing shortages everywhere. And so, you know, sure, if more people could have made it out of their early nursing curricula courses because they got some AI assistance to learn better, that would be wonderful. But the real reason there's a nursing shortage is because hospitals are being starved of funds so that the insurance companies can return more to the shareholders. So we're trying to do everything as much on the cheap as possible while also making sure that the money goes to, you know, private individuals. So I'm trying to say that AI, I think, could help a little bit here, but I don't want it to end up then continuing the redistribution of resources upwards, like, which is probably what it's designed for. You know, the reason to eliminate jobs is so that companies can make just as much money and pay fewer workers. And I don't know how to do this. Like, this is why I said earlier in our conversation that the humanities people at Yale who've talked to me about large language models have not been thinking about their students cheating, but about the structure of society towards profit.
More the societal implications, yeah. I think this idea of somehow serving students better, using AI to serve students better, I know personally it could have helped me a lot because I went through a very tough engineering program. I almost failed out of the program. And there's just, I just could not get enough of time with the TAs to really help me get over the hurdle. And there's a point at which, if I'm not getting the fundamental concept, I got to stop asking the questions because it's like they don't have the patience to help me get through the fundamental concepts, because there's plenty of other students who got it, you know, And maybe, Tony, you shouldn't be an engineer because you're not getting this, you know? And I just needed a little bit of help. And I think AI could have helped me with those fundamental questions because I could keep on asking it the same question.
Absolutely.
In a thousand different ways. It won't get impatient. It's not going to be like, oh my, hey, look, my TA hours are from 2 to 4 and you've taken up 30 minutes, dude. You know, I need to help some other students. And maybe I needed 2 hours to get that concept. And to me, I mean, there's kind of that sort of work that it could do for someone that's really trying to learn, you know. There's people going to be using it to cheat, you know, of course. But then there's going to be people like me trying to get through the program. You know, I need all the help I can get. And
I love what you're saying. It really matches my experience of basically how people learn. I mean, most of my direct experiences with higher ed, but I know a lot of these things are true for younger people too, that, for instance, you said being able to ask the question a bunch of different ways or get different kinds of answers. And as you know, you can ask a large language model that gives you an answer and you don't quite understand it. You can say, focus on this part and say it again. Or I'm going to ask the question a little bit differently. Please give me a different answer. Like, and there's just there's research that shows that the best teachers are actually, there's a term in composition, it's called boundary translators. And what that means is that it's not your mastery of the subject that makes you an excellent teacher, although it's a factor. It's your ability to translate the material differently for people who are at different levels of understanding or coming from different angles on it. In other words, if your understanding is deep enough that when one person asks you, you know, what's fun about it, you can give an answer that has the basic truth, but angles of fun. And when someone else asks you, you know, what are the long-term political implications for the redistribution of wealth, you can give a different kind of answer. And then when someone else says, what's the hardest thing about this that I should master first, you can give a different answer. All of them are fundamentally the same, but they're different, genuinely different, because they're answering different forms of the question. So you saying that if you had a chance to work with AI on some of these concepts, I think you're right. And it probably would have been true right now. And 10 years from now, I think we both would imagine it'll be even better at giving different kinds of answers and changing the answers a little bit to fix understanding. So my experience of just, you know, Google, there's a period of self-learning that happened when Google got decent. I was already a grown-up, but I got smarter about a lot of things because you could get access to, obviously, sometimes thousands of different people's answers, but quickly the top 10 hits of answers to a particular question, and you could compare the different answers and use them to kind of synthesize, oh, I get it. This is what people are getting at. These are the two camps. And then you could, you know, then to go critical literacy, you could look at the sources of those different answers and weigh them differently. This one comes from, you know, a nonprofit, and this one comes from a victim, you know, an individual victim, and this one is the government. And that would be information that would be important too. Like, this is work that a really good AI will do for students and is therefore a little bit problematic. But anyway, I just want to say having access to different languages, different formulations of the same information really can help people enhance their learning. So I agree with you about that potential. I think there's tremendous potential in that of a large language model that has a lot of information in it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that to me is I call it a use case, you know, a use case where it could really support the learning. You know, if for someone that's truly wanting to understand the concept, and it could have helped me a lot back in school because I know there were certain fundamental concepts I was not getting. And then, you know, if you don't get it in the first month of a class, you're lost. At this point, it's like this hopeless trying to scramble back up the cliff because you realize, oh no, there's something fundamentally I'm not getting. You know, and it's a terrible feeling. You know, I've had that in classes, and
yeah. It's not good for motivation. Like, you know, never mind self-worth. It can reduce your motivation to continue plugging.
Yeah, there's two more things I'd like to get your thoughts on, and anything else you might have on your mind. So, one is around evaluation. So we talked about learning, the teaching of learning, the feedback, the front end of the process, I guess, or the evaluating. Are there any conversations of using AI to grade? You know, like, to what extent is that being discussed? at present? Because there's, I didn't see any guidance on that, actually, on your website. And to me, that's a possible application. And there's some theoretical arguments of why that's good, because it's fair. Maybe it's better not to know the context of the student when grading them on their final exam. You know, like you might grade someone differently if you knew their backstory versus if you didn't. If they happen to be one of the person that was really demanding of your time and you're now invested in that student, you might grade that student differently than someone that you didn't hear a peep from the entire semester, you know? So any conversations at the university around using AI to grade in any domain?
I have only heard sarcastic references to this so far at Yale when I was on campus. I've read slightly more sober back and forths on Facebook Facebook group I belong to that I really like. It's called something like Higher Ed Discussions of AI. It's very, very thoughtful people. And there's a little bit of talk about it there. It's not policy. So just so you know, the Poover Center doesn't actually set policy. We give guidance for like coaches, but there's guidance on the page brand new. It's like it went up yesterday that says, please don't submit your students' work to any large language model because you don't own it. You don't own your students' work, so you can't give it to things. That's a starting point right now. You know, as you know, the page encourages people to try these things out. But it basically says you can try your own assignments, but you can't put in students' answers to learn more. Not yet, at least. So that's part of the discussion has been. So obviously, if you can't put it in even just to explore, we're telling you don't put it in to grade.
Yeah, but that's very temporary because you can imagine some AI startup who has the right, I guess, security and policy mm-hmm. guidelines where, hey, look, we're not going to, like, your work is yours, you know, it's protected, we're not going to use it for anything. So it will give you all the assurances you like. It's targeted especially for teachers to help them grade, you know? Like, so in that world, like, is there a conversation about?
Yeah. I started with a narrow and therefore somewhat unbrave answer to your question, like, because obviously the next layer, which is, is there a way to leverage AI's ability to analyze text to student advantage that doesn't just look like passing off your grading work to a machine? And it's a complicated question. You know, again, to go back to what computer scientists at Yale have told me, and I knew this already, they have been using a form of machine grading for programs for a long time. Like, not every single thing, but that, you know, you can put somebody's program in a computer to see if it works, like that it's a thing that it does. That's what they're for. And so it's certainly not the case that you can't use tools to grade students. But I am not hearing a lot of robust conversation about this, and I expect that I will. So, you know, the focus in the spring, to my characterization of it, would be don't panic. There are ways you can teach mostly the same way for the rest of the spring without having to worry about the large language models. And now what I heard over the summer was, how much are you prepared to restructure your courses, either to start to make room for students to use AI in ways that you deem appropriate, you know, for certain parts of the tasks, or to, we haven't really talked about this before, but if you redesign your course for learning so that there are more instances of small engagement with the material, you both take out the value of a large language model in producing a final paper because you've sort of pushed the emphasis away from the final paper anyway, and you put students in a place where when it's time to write the final paper, they're, even if they have access to a large language model, a lot more of the work will be their own because they've done small pieces of work both to know what they're talking about and to have an investment in the material. That this is relevant to your question of how much discussion of grading have I heard is because I haven't been hearing this summer people saying, how can I use it to do my grading? But rather, how can I grade the slightly different version of the course that I'm designing so that a large language model's text generating ability is not a big factor in how students do their work next year? You know, we're having a workshop on August 24th, and it's possible that people in the last 3 weeks have been, as school gets close, have been cooking a lot harder on what they do or don't want to do, what they're afraid of or not afraid of. I may get a ton of questions about this. But for the most part, I think, especially in the humanities and most of the social sciences here, classes are small enough that it's not going to be people's first idea to publicly explore how they could turn their grading over to an AI, even though what you said is true. There are some ways in which you can imagine it being more fair, more objective, more consistent. I think those things are true. But I think there would be a bit of a concern that it would make you look bad if you were talking about, you know, when you have 18 students in one class and 12 in the other, that you're going to, you know, you're going to put your students' work in a machine to find out how they did.
Actually, so this is a bridge onto the final thing I want to get your thoughts on. And it's the thing that you have the most expertise on, which is teaching people to write and what do you think is the right combination of how to use AI for that? And so on the flip side is also evaluating people's writing. And I think AI could be taught what a good composition looks like. And to me, an interesting experiment to run is like, well, if you're to grade a bunch of students, how would AI grade those exact same students? And where there's a discrepancy is where you might want to take a second look. You know, you're grading someone high, it grades it low. Or the opposite, you grade it low, they grade it high. You know, I think to me, that might be an interesting way to use AI that doesn't negate the role of the teacher and their ability to evaluate, but augment. Because we're people, you know, our judgments of people are influenced by our experience of them. And, you know, some of this is subjective, you know, and that's where AI could remove the subjectivity. So it's kind of a, you know, these are two things I want to get your thoughts on. Just we could close this conversation about grading and then maybe go on to, I want to get your personal thoughts on how you think AI should be used in the teaching of writing.
So I feel very excited about your question and the scenario you've described of having a set of papers, grading them myself, having a large language model and AI take a look at them and sort them and rank them or grade them, and then comparing the discrepancies. I love this for a hundred reasons. The one you've emphasized, I think, is super important, not maybe the most important, which is just as a way to check my own biases that are maybe based upon my individual experience of students, or maybe based on race, class, and gender, or the student's accent. Like, I think there are all kinds of ways in which getting more information about how a different way of looking at the same work might jar me to look again at that work. Because there's definitely true that I have all those biases. I mean, I try to work against them, but I definitely have them. And to do a better job of working around them, talking about them differently, eliminating them from my grading policy, those are all values. Co-teaching gives you some of this same experience. Like, I find co-teaching thrilling and frustrating for the very reason you're talking about, because you are made to rethink things, which is both the genuine joy of life and takes more time and sometimes feels frustrating and makes you feel stupid. So, like, I really, really love this. I'm going to give a Pollyanna version of how what you're saying is also right for a different reason. So let's imagine I graded a bunch of papers and then I put them through AI and the AI gave it completely different grades. But we make the assumption for a moment that I'm actually right. What that experience could allow me to do is explain much better what I'm looking for. In other words, if in every case where there was a discrepancy, it turned out that the paper I liked better was actually better, it could be because I did not tell ChatGPT, or it does not know, the value of ambiguity. Like in the paper that I told a story earlier, which may or may not be in this podcast, about having my students look at a student paper from a first year at Yale and a ChatGPT answer to the same question, some of the things that we noticed in the paper were places where the student acknowledged a little bit more uncertainty or ambiguity, but didn't just try to split the baby 50-50, didn't say it could be this or it could be that, but rather sort of had an angle where it's like, all right, there's room for 10% doubt here. And that might be something I haven't explained very well, but I really do value. And when I look at the ChatGPT differences, I realize, oh, you know what I really liked about this paper? Something I didn't articulate and I didn't say, and I didn't therefore tell the model to look for. And that's incredibly valuable to my students. If I can say more clearly and with more nuance, what's really valuable to me in the good, the work that I think is good. And I genuinely believe that both of these are true, Tony, that I would learn things that I hadn't meant and I would correct for them. And I would see things that I do care about, but I hadn't articulated very well. And both of those would improve my evaluation. Absolutely. I think it's a great scenario you've just described.
Yeah, it's interesting where, like, to me, the most positive use case is, students become better learners, teachers become better teachers. You know, that would be the ideal scenario. So, okay, let's talk about writing. And do you have a position at the moment? Like, let's call it a personal position, like, because, again, like, you're not setting policy for the university. But, like, to what extent do you think AI should be used to in the assistance of teaching people to write? Because, you know, you can easily imagine a world where, a dystopian world where people don't know how to write anymore. So what's your current thinking on this?
So I think this time I really will say three things. I have three things I'm thinking of. And the third one is giant and has a million parts, but the first two are simpler. I have already given advice to the Center for International and Professional Experience at Yale about writing that students do whose purpose is to get a job. Like, it's external writing that's not strictly for the purpose of learning and scholarship. And my advice, it's just my advice, has been, yes, it should be okay for students to use ChatGPT to help compose cover letters and resumes, because even though they might, those do sometimes get used to test whether someone's intelligent or thoughtful, they are on their surface information delivery systems, and what's the only thing that's really important about them is that they're true. So what you say on your resume has to be what you really did. It's not supposed to be a test of whether you're a good bullet point writer.
Writer, yeah.
Yeah. And so my advice has been that, you know, I've been using a template for doing resumes since I was in high school, and I went to high school in the 80s. You know, so even though you could find a difference between how well two people write a resume, it's not supposed to be the main thing they get tested on for getting a job. So I'm saying there are settings in which getting help on making the prose better, on generating it in the first place, on organizing it, when you provide the information and the material and you have a chance to then go back and correct it for errors and things it makes up, that seems good to me. It seems good that students would be able to get help with some template writing, you know, some transactional writing. I don't mean to make a huge distinction in all settings between commercial writing and private writing. I think they blur plenty of times, but if I temporarily make one, and I think that's similar, you know, students who are fluent in multiple languages sometimes make more errors in the target language that their letter has to go in, you know, for instance, English. And I think it's fine in some settings for them to use a tool to improve that. You know, Grammarly and, you know, Microsoft Word had grammar and spelling built in for years. Like, so I don't think running your cover letter through ChatGPT is much, you know, to make sure you're not making a lot of grammar errors is much worse than any of those things. And I also think it's fine. So that's one setting where the text is not supposed to be evaluated for the your stage of learning in a certain setting so that someone can give you meaningful feedback to move forward. It's supposed to be like delivering information. There's one. And then there's another, the second one, which is, I can't even describe it that well, but it's like in the future. And when students are writing about huge sets of data that they're collecting from multiple places at once, and they need like a first pass of two or three points that are either discrepant or synthesized in them. And frankly, there are people at Yale who even my describing this, they're going to be like, no, I don't want them to use artificial intelligence for that. But I feel like there's a scale of work students could get to use, like uploading a lot of text for analysis into a large language model or other forms of generative AI that would allow them just to complete work they couldn't do otherwise. I don't know exactly what those are, but I just, you know, I just read a Substack about somebody putting in I think it's called Code Generator. Do you know, there's an AI tool that basically can do numbers, and they, you know, they put up like 50 things in there and they didn't publish the results. They just said, oh, here's two things that I'm now going to go back and read all of these same texts looking for these two things so I can think about how they really are related. And so it was like, I don't know. And I'm not 100% sure about this one, but it's like a making your work go at a bigger scale. Eventually, you're going to write it, but it's not about the prose so much as about the evidence, like taking a pass at the evidence.
Yes. I'm waiting for your number three.
Yeah, so number three is...
Because I guess my original question was not kind of teaching people to write, you know, teaching people how to really compose and write.
Yeah. I haven't imagined too many scenarios for the current formation of large language models to really help people become much better writers. It may be that because I work in an elite institution. And so some of the kind, like if I put something in ChatGPT and ask it to give me feedback, it gives me feedback on like sentence length and, you know, occasionally that instead of which, like it's sort of like a corrector. And the truth is, the research on having your writing corrected is not very strong on how well it helps you learn. For instance, feedback on sentence level errors, the research shows that the most powerful form of feedback on a sentence level error is for someone to put a dot in the margin of your paper, period. That's it. And the art is in picking which places to put a dot. In other words, so you give me a piece.
What do you mean?
Yeah, okay, dot? No problem. So you give me a page of writing, and one of your goals is for the sentences to get better, fewer errors, fewer repetitions, yeah. You know. Mm-hmm. And what most teachers do initially, most higher ed teachers do, the first thing they do is they correct everything that they don't like, and they write the corrections right into the sentence. Well, the research shows mm-hmm. that that's the least effective way to make you, Tony, be better at writing that same kind of sentence in the future. Mm-hmm. The most effective way is for me to pick one or two things that I really want you to get better mm-hmm. at, and literally put a dot next to the line in the paper and give it back to you and say, there's something wrong in the two places where I marked a dot. Go work on it.
Mainly meaning that it's the process of trying to figure out what may be the problem that is where the learning occurs.
Yeah, correct. Okay. For you to more right. effectively do that in the future, I have to just tell you where to go back and do some more work. So what... Most of my friends who are writing teachers, we do something in between those two. We try not to correct. Like if you every word that you write that's supposed to go into the student's paper is a bypassed opportunity for them to find that word. But we try to mark the places where we have concerns and name them.
Okay. But why AI could do that? You could ask AI, hey, look, identify a few places where there's room for improvement without telling me what I should do, right? So in that way, like it could be part of this, like a student could be using that to help their writing before they even submit this something to you, yeah.
Yes, definitely. And I'm trying to say, I want to say yes, but have the yes be really strong because I have been using the example of sentence level clarity or error. And I agree with you that if you told it, don't tell me how to fix this, but rather pick the two most egregious places and just show me where they are and I'll work on it. Yes. But sentence level error is not the most, like I said, I said at some point, maybe because I work in an elite institution, sentence level error is not the most robust place that I give feedback. So when I give my writing, as I said, to ChatGPT and say, help me make this better, it gives me sentence level feedback. And, you know, if I trained it to not tell me exactly how to fix it, but instead to just point it out, yeah, that would help. But I tend, like my best feedback that I give to students is to say, there's a subtle difference between how angry you sound in paragraph one and paragraph four. And either you should write something that shows you're moving in your thinking, or you got to somehow reconcile these two.
Oh, interesting. In this hypothetical example, are you pointing that out because it's interfering with the point they're trying to make? Or like, is it breaking some rule? Is it interfering with the point they're trying to make? Or like, is it there's some, it's just not as beautiful sounding. Like it's a more of an artistic quality.
Yeah. Those are wonderful choices for real. Like those are all legit scenarios or principles or motivations for giving people feedback. And none of them are the one I was thinking of in my hypothetical scenario. So, but those are all legit. The one I was thinking of was, I think you might have something more powerful to say than you're claiming in this paper. I actually think you hate this text, or I think you feel disgusted by the choice that the character made, or I think you think the author actually endorses this despite showing that it's an unreliable narrator. The author actually really does believe in this, and I want you to say that. Like, I think where you've gotten to in paragraph 4 is where you really are. And so if you're going to start us with something soft and gentle at the beginning, then write something in that says, but that's not all that's going on. There's more going on here. Ultimately, it's problematic. Like, so what I'm in most of the classes I teach now, I've taught a lot of different kinds of writing classes, but in most of them, students are reading texts that don't have certain answers. Sometimes it's literature, sometimes it's nonfiction, but nonfiction like that has like a rich rereading of, you know, like Letter from a Birmingham Jail, which is, I got a pretty strong argument about how the world is unjust, but is sort of subtle in saying, you know, nice white people who are afraid of making trouble are actually worse in some ways than racists who tell me they hate me because they're harder to change. Like there's something subtle going on is what I mean. So most of what my students are writing about are texts or movies or written texts that have some uncertainty, ambiguity, because narrative makes its points in a more complex way than rules. And I'm trying to get them to write about the richness and to get to what they really believe and how, you know, watching Get Out makes them want to remake the world that they live in. And so my feedback is often about trying to listen for either, are you thinking something that you haven't been able to say yet? Or are you saying about the text something simpler than it's saying, so I can push you to go back and read some more. So like I'm saying that literary work, at least in the sort of teacher I am, is about finding and developing new and slightly surprising ideas about how to engage the material. So all of that was just to say, I mean, I definitely think, I guess you're right that if I thought clarity was the number one goal, I could imagine AI that's well instructed, giving decent feedback on that. I certainly can imagine a future in which it can read for ambiguity. I'm not saying that doesn't, but it doesn't now.
Yes. Well, I think there could be an experiment that you run for yourself using ChatGPT on this because, you know, you can give it different roles and, you know, you can give it the role of you are a writing professor and give it kind of a mock essay and say, like, you can kind of see what kind of feedback as a writing professor you would give to this student and see if it gets, maybe stage it a little bit, like create an example where you kind of build in the problem and see if AI would give the same kind of feedback you would. To me, these are just interesting experiments to run just to test the state of the technology, because like what you just articulated about like kind of you're pushing the student a bit. You're like, hey, look, what are you really trying to say? You know, what are you really trying to say? Maybe there's a more powerful way. There's some things getting in the way. You're kind of pushing on the student. And that's a very particular kind of feedback. And and I think it's great. Like, that's kind of what I need, you know, like that's kind of what I hope to get when I have teachers. They push on me a bit. And I don't know if AI can do that, but it may, you know. So that's why, like, a lot of the things I'm surprised at what it can do, you know. So to me, I always try to massage prompts to get the limits of, like, what is this thing really, what can it really do? I kind of want to know what the state of the art is.
Yeah. And, well, the example you sent me, an Ethan Mollick Substack post about giving feedback, and the the elaborate instructions were, I hadn't ever thought of saying to ChatGPT, first ask me this, wait for a response. Then, you know, ask me this question about my response, wait for a response. Like, I had never realized that you could give like a five-step prompt that also gave evaluative criteria for each of the steps. Like, I haven't gone that far with it before. So I'm still pretty sure it can't do that yet, but I agree with you, or at least I accept your advice that it's only, I'm only going to find out by trying it, and it's only going to get there if people nudge it. You know, I'll also say that this, you know, not everybody wants the same thing from the world of writing. I mostly think about it as a tool for learning, for developing certain habits of mind, for getting a feel for what a deep and problematic claim is like. I don't just teach students a formula for getting to certain kinds of ideas, but rather I sort of push them towards them and I say, okay, do you feel a certain combination of zeal and unease? Now you're in the realm of an idea that might actually change somebody's mind. Like, this is where we're going. You're like, try something and then pay attention to yourself. This is going to feel like a, maybe a little bit of a swerve, but one thing I say all the time, so I also run a writing center. Like, I work on courses and I teach my own courses, but I have a writing center with about 100 student tutors. And the tutors are great. They know a lot about writing. They know how to ask questions. But one of the things I say to them is, if you start the session by asking the student, what are you trying to accomplish in this paper? And, you know, where does it feel like it's working or not working? And the student answers you, half of the work of the tutorial is over in those first 5 minutes, because most people don't get prompted or prompt themselves to say in a slightly different way or in a slightly different context what they're trying to do. They don't reflect on their work aloud or in words. And the act of doing that helps people have insights that they can then go back to revise their work. And you may have heard of this example. There's a similar example that I read about from computer programming. It's called rubber duck debugging. And it's where if you just, you literally explain the problem you're having with the program to a rubber duck, it makes you make progress in solving the problem. Because, you know, reflection is a powerful tool. And if you create opportunities for it, people benefit from it. So I know what I just said is true. Given that it's true, there's probably a role for, you know, a back and forth chatbot there. Just remembering my caution earlier from, I think some of why it works is because the social part of our brain, not the language part, is bringing emotion to bear in a different way to a human interlocutor than it would to a system designed to produce better work.
Having AI help you produce good output is different than having it be a good teacher. But you could actually have it play the role of the teacher. Like, one of the things that you mentioned, that if you corrected someone, they're not going to learn as much as if you just identify more vaguely, here, look, work, this area needs improvement, try to figure it out. You know, I wouldn't know that because I've never taught writing before. AI could be a good teacher too, if you ask it to be. And that's why I'm really curious if you experiment. We'll have another chat and you can tell me if...
I will say that, you know, the average student benefits from multiple modes of feedback. So a dot in the margin, one place that's been corrected as an example, but then you point to two more that have the same problem. I told you, I tend to label the kind of thing I'm trying to fix. So giving it a name so students can think about that category, looking at good examples, correcting other people's, like, you know, the average student benefits from all of those modes. And you're right that one thing I now have come to understand lately is that you could give an AI bot multiple instructions, like read this paper, pick the most problematic error, and then give one example of how to fix it, one other place in the text to go back and look at, and try to name the major writing issue that it, you know. And of course, good teachers try to do all those things, but you could probably do a little more of it if you had, you know, some technical assistance.
I think you could extract this sort of great results from AI because you know exactly the kinds of questions and how you can do the prompting. I feel like we are just scratching the surface on this topic. I feel like this is the beginning of a conversation. And I know you're out of time. I really appreciate you speaking with me in really covering so many diverse topics and providing some very thoughtful answers. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this conversation, so thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us at the Super Prompt Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to this podcast and leave us a 5-star review. See you next week at Super Prompt.